Hello, and welcome to the third episode of the podcast of Life Dunk. We're recording this as the news of the earthquake in Myanmar is unfolding. Every news bulletin tells us of increasing death tolls and shows more pictures of destruction. This month's podcast is about the fragility of our world and how we cope when terrible events happen. We'll discuss how we deal with shocking events, and we'll explore whether that's different if that happens to us as individuals or as a community. Is there a difference between enduring collective suffering as opposed to individual pain? I'm Amber Gilmorris, and in the studio with me is Rabbi Miriam Berger and psychiatrist Dr. Mark Borelowitz. Hello.
Hello.
Morning.
So, who do we blame when things go wrong, Miriam? Do we hold God responsible? Let's go for Biggie.
I mean, that is quite the way in. Let's start by blaming God. And I think it's really interesting because there's definitely language around blaming God. And the kind of the biggest font of that kind of language comes out of post-Holocaust theology. But for me, there's not really a difference between the 6 million who died during the Holocaust and, you know, one baby lying in a hospital bed with an incurable illness. Both can lead us to that question of framing, how can God allow this to happen? But I do think the kind of succinct nature of some of those Holocaust theologians are quite helpful. And if you think about kind of three main ones, so you've got Eliezer Berkowitz, for instance, who talks about the Hester Panim, the hidden face of God at times of tragedy. So he's saying, look, people have free will and we don't understand our bodies and why terrible things happen. And therefore, what we should really do is be comforted by a God who has to kind of turn away from why these things happen, but is kind of struggling with us, that we get a comforting God who's sort of sad with us in our sadness. Or Emil Fackenheim, who tells us that the 614th commandment is not to hand Hitler a posthumous victory, that actually he gives us the language of being able to say, it's not what's happened to us, it's how we respond to it that's important. And it's actually Richard Rubenstein who sort of says, you know, this is the death of God. The covenant ended at the Holocaust. That how can you possibly believe in God once you've blamed God for this atrocity? But actually in later life, Rubenstein sort of really changes track a bit and revokes that post-Holocaust theology. And I think it's really interesting because I think what he realized was, what are we left with if we blame God? Actually finding the language which gives us a supportive, comforting God that walks life's journey with us, that's sad with us and supports us, is actually a kind of more useful concept to us than the God that we rage against, who we sort of turn away from. Have I got time for one anecdote? Because I love it, although I don't think I behaved so well in it. But I was doing a interfaith panel at QE Girls School because actually one of our wonderful producers, Susie's daughter, had asked me to come in. And it was a great panel, and they'd got like an imam and a priest and me, the rabbi, and also someone from the Humanist Society. And before it started, I was chatting with the humanist guy who was on crutches, and he'd said, he'd been walking in the mountains that weekend and he'd broken his ankle. He'd slipped and broken his ankle. Anyway, the panel is going really well. And one of the girls says to the humanist, did you ever believe in God? And he said, well, actually, yes, I came from a very observant Christian family. We were very involved in our church. But unfortunately, a decade ago, my nephew was mountain climbing and fell to his death. And none of my family have walked into church since. And in a moment of kind of rage for God, really supporting God at this moment, I just turned to him and went, well, that's ludicrous. How is it that after that event, you didn't walk into church, but you have been back on the mountains? And look, you've even broken your ankle, you know, this last weekend. God can't protect us from our own stupidity. Now, I realise that was not the kindest thing to say, but at that moment, it was the kind of outrage that how can we put God on trial in these moments? We're given the free will and we're given the beauty of nature to explore in our own way. But that idea that of a God that should sort of pluck us from danger and keep us safe despite the dangers we put ourselves in is a very fragile God concept that he's proven, you very easily walk away from and doesn't really support you through life.
So Mark, blame in the clinical context, does it help or hinder healing?
Blame is terrible for healing, but gosh, it's... one can well understand why people are inclined to blame. And the people I see who've suffered medical negligence or been in accidents are terribly pained by a question of why me? And they tend not to have an answer, but it's sad. People who've been in accidents feel guilty. And they find it hard to explain to themselves or to me why they feel guilty. Someone I saw earlier this week felt guilty about how much looking after her mum had to do for her after the accident. But there was also another kind of guilt about actually having been in the accident at all, although it was entirely out of her control. Something fell on her. And so, gosh, I can see how God or something like God could be a comfort.
So there are people and cultures who don't seem to have the same why me response to tragedy. And Mark, you've had very direct experience of you, haven't you? And I wonder if you could talk us through your work with the boys who were trapped in the Thai cave and what that was.
In 2018, a group of Thai schoolboys and their football coach in northern Thailand, part of a football team, were trapped by flood waters in a cave in northern Thailand. I've met two of them, and my very close colleague met all of them and some of their family members. They're unusual. They were already a team. They went into the cave with their football coach at the end of football practice, believe it or not, for a bit of a team-building experience. And... they were then trapped by floodwaters. They had a bit of the Nietzschean stuff. They were already a team. They were boys from the countryside. They knew what was safe water to drink, what wasn't safe water. They were used to cold and heat and being slightly uncomfortable and all that kind of thing, and that didn't bother them. But they had something unbelievably important. They had an unshakable belief that their society would rescue them. And so they didn't take risks. They didn't try to get out themselves. If they had tried, they would have died, for sure. They didn't try to. And that was very helpful. And the other thing was that they were aware that although they had, I've called it an unshakable belief, not everybody's belief was equally strong all the time, and they comforted one another. So they functioned as a close-knit little community, and they retained a fantastic sense of community and priorities. So they decided who should come out first. And it's quite interesting that no professional people, no politician overrode this decision. Who did they decide should come out first? The boys who lived furthest away from the cave, because everybody boy needed to see his family as soon as possible. They didn't know the families were waiting right outside.
I love that idea.
They wanted them to see their families as soon as possible. So whoever lived furthest away should go out first. I mean, isn't it incredible that they were altruistic?
I love that idea. As if they would all eventually arrive home at the same time, if they set off staggered. I mean, that is...
Yeah, so it's a fabulous idea. And then after being in the cave, the vast majority of them aspired to let go of that and live ordinary lives. And when I had the privilege of going to the area where the caves were and meeting with two of the boys, and I also met with the head teacher of the local school, and she whispered to me, Mark, I knew one of the boys was in my school. I didn't realize the other one was in my school too. You know, it's only one school and they're just not celebrities.
Right. And the idea that they could have been through something like that and even the head teacher didn't even know.
You know, I feel incredibly privileged that I met these boys, you know, and the head of the village, who had the very difficult job of trying to give hope to the families while preparing for 13 funerals.
And do you think your part of your job as a rabbi is building community resilience?
Absolutely. And I think what religious communities done well do so well is show you what it could be, you know, the microcosm of a bigger society, sort of what could this be if scaled up? So for me, there's always going to be within a community context, individual suffering. But a community that's well established should have the ability to be able to say, so what's our role when others suffer? I think for me, a huge element of individual suffering is the isolation that it leads to. So when there's a collective suffering, it tends not to have the same knock-on effect into isolation. And so for me, the real kind of sense of community responsibility is how do you acknowledge that when someone is suffering, how do you help them realize they're not alone? And I think there's something about collective responsibility giving a kind of greater purpose for people in their lives and therefore being able to see a little bit past what they're going through or what's going on. You know, we have a bit of a joke in our family. You know, people who know me will have heard me talk about playing the lottery and now and again, because there's always that hope that surely if what I'm trying to do is build Wellspring, build a mikveh, you know, support Jewish community in all sorts of different ways, surely my numbers are more likely to come up than someone who wants to buy a yacht or, you know, go on a holiday. Surely that's how statistics work, no? But I do think there's something interesting about what does it mean for, you know, my son growing up to know that I play the lottery so that this is the charity work that we can do with no real sense of, oh, yes, and then you'll have designer trainers and clothes. That's never part of the conversation. You know, that's not why we, you know, that's not what I'm doing this for. So that collective responsibility piece and knowing our individual needs are so set within a much bigger framework, I think takes away the isolationism.
And did you see things differently when the community suffered collective trauma?
I think we end up coming out for each other. So, you know, sadly, October the 7th was one of those collective trauma moments. And, you know, the following Shabbat could have been a place where we all individually said, is it going to be safe to put ourselves in a public Jewish space right now? Let's not be in synagogue. And actually, it was one of the many Shabbatot we didn't have enough seats out because that had been a hunch and a fear. But actually, people came in their masses, particularly sort of, you know, young adults who hadn't been in shul for a number of years, were there with, you know, non-Jewish partners and spouses and stuff saying, this is who I am. We have suffered collectively, and now we need to show up for one another and be there and get through this together. So whether it was October 7th or all the creativity around the pandemic, I also think what the pandemic proves is, look, you know, it was during the pandemic, I think, where that amazing film came out about kind of the AIDS crisis, and it was so especially stark that what we were creating in terms of a vaccine so quickly during the pandemic, when it was all of us in need, you know, so starkly set against the how many years did it take to develop the vaccine when it was for a group of people that were seen as other to the collective and therefore, you know, clearly not prioritized in nearly the same way.
And in your work, Mark, how do you see individualism as affecting well-being?
OK, Can I come back to the pandemic and community, please? I think I'm agreeing with Miriam 100%, 1,000%. And the pandemic was actually an accidental experiment in the value of community. So at my hospital, there was a morning meeting every day at 8 a.m. planning the work. And it was led by a charismatic guy. And one day he said, so who's the physician in charge today? And someone put their hand up and they said, I am. But I'm not an infectious diseases person. I'm a dermatologist. And eight people said, I'm here to help senior doctors. I'm here to help you. Call me anytime. Completely available to help you. And that atmosphere pervaded the entire organization. And I remember talking to senior managers who said, actually, there's something nice about the community spirit. I mean, COVID is terrifying, but there's something about the spirit that we would like to keep going when COVID is over. So, much though I don't like the way he put it, there was some value in Nietzsche's idea that adversity can, under the right circumstances, help you get a bit stronger. And we noticed as COVID was going away and this cooperative spread was attenuating, in a way we started to miss. We missed it. And now, you know, October the 7th is a different kind of thing, but I think it's an example of adversity striking and individuals within the community saying we need to feel together and to show that we are together. We can't not react, and the right way to react is to be more communal. And that's how could societies have survived all the adversity over thousands of years if they didn't react communally to plague, shortages, avalanches, buildings falling down, or the need for a vaccine to become available for 8 billion people really rather quickly?
And would you like to recommend to some of your patients, your clients who you see, who don't have community, to help? Would that be, if you could have a magic wand and that would be part of in your toolbox, would you like to be able to kind of, would you see that as something helpful for them?
Yes. And I'm thinking of several different kinds of communities. So one parent who I know outside the office who has a child with a complex disability says the only people who really, really understand her are parents in a similar plight. And she has a WhatsApp group with 58 people on it. And they are a community. They feel they understand one another in the way, like me as a child psychiatrist, I will never understand them. So that kind of community is important. But also the wider community that gives you the support you need with jobs and money and a place to go and a bat mitzvah that takes into account your child's communication issues and still allows her to have a wonderful bat mitzvah. So it's not just about your support group. It's about all the positive things that the community can do for you that are essential. Yeah. If you just have the support group, I think you're at risk of feeling more down and being a bit more stuck than you might otherwise be.
And do you think, I mean, there's a massive rise in mental health problems, and there's a rise in individualism and a decline in religious communities, apart from anything else, and other sort of social networking things as we all become stuck to our phones rather than face-to-face conversation. Do you see those as linked or not, do you think?
I think we're supposed to reflect. But being too internally focused doesn't do us any good. And doing good deeds for others is incredibly helpful, actually. At a selfish point of view, it makes one feel better. And try it, just holding a door open for somebody when you're in a rush. So it's a small, mundane task, helping somebody cross the road. It fires up bits of the brain that make us feel happier and a bit more valuable. And if you're isolated and in your room, you don't get that. So somehow trying to get out there and being away from your internal focus and me trying to help some other people with their needs or just having fun is really, really important. And I have so many young male clients who go to the gym with their buddies. They're all depressed. They go to the gym together to cheer one another up. It works. And they don't talk about their depression when they're in the gym.
Miriam?
It's interesting, the gym also, because it's about goal setting as yeah. well and achieving goals.
Yeah.
And so I suspect that's also part of it. I think there's something about being able to kind of ask three questions. The what do I need?
Yeah.
The who could I ask? And the where do I feel kind of safe or appreciated or held or kind of, you know, different. And it's unusual for anybody to be able to have to answer those questions really by saying nothing. You know, there's nobody I can ask. There's nothing that anybody could do that would help. And there's nowhere other than my bedroom and being on my own that will, that makes a difference. But sometimes those questions and really understanding, you know, who could I ask? And how brave do I need to be to admit that that's the person I need to ask when maybe I'm not the person they would ask? But that piece that Mark said about, you know, most people do good things, not in an altruistic way, but because it gives people a sense of purpose. And I think we're not very good at realizing, you know, and Judaism does acknowledge that actually you're providing someone with the ability to do a mitzvah, you know, a good deed, actually asking is a good thing. It's a very Jewish thing because you're enabling somebody else to do what they should already be doing. So I think for me, there's that question of if you're able to ask those who, what and where questions, I think for a lot of people, you know, in my world, that often does take us into a religious community space, but that's not everybody's answers to the who, what, and where. They'll find their people, their community, and create that community for them and around them in whatever way they're able to.
And do you think there's a tension between, I mean, there's a community religious space has a necessity or has a kind of higher purpose in terms of not just, I don't mean just the sort of the God bit, but just helping each other, not just out of self-interest. Whereas what you were referencing, say, particularly with the parent group, was not self-interest, that makes it sound really negative, but it isn't there to do anything else but support those people in that particular area. Do you see that as a difference?
A lot of people, including myself, want from time to time to be understood by someone who really knows what it's like to be oneself. And if you're a marginalized parent and you feel guilt and shame, you would be wise to pick very carefully the people in whom you confide, because you need them to react to you in the right kind of way. So I really, really understand the value of those groups, and thank goodness they exist. I don't mean to insert any but. I think at the same time, getting out, every time one does a little bit of good, one feels better and society becomes better. If you donate blood, you've done a good thing. If you destroy the power supply to the blood bank and ruin 500 litres of precious blood, you've really, really undermined society. And again, I'm not an evolutionary, you know, I'm not an expert in evolution, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but again, I don't think we would have survived if society had more in it, more blood bank destroyers than blood bank donors, because we had gone a long time ago. So to make it easy, you know, what Aristotle would say, make it easy for people to be blood bank donors. That's the job of leadership. Make it easy for people to be blood bank donors. Simple as that.
I like that. Do you like that, Miriam?
I do, because I think there's something about what it means to be able to give people very easy expressions of, you know, it's so simple. You know, for me, along the same lines, it never made sense to me why not everyone would be an organ donor. You know,
yeah.
Once you're dead, why would you not, you know, give life? And it was fascinating when my husband was on a a campaign to get more people to join the stem cell register when his mum was looking for a match. It was kind of fascinating to me to hear the people who said no, that they didn't want to join the register. Because for me, there was this sense of like, wow, how many people are given the opportunity to save a life in their world, you know, in their day to day? The extraordinary privilege of being able to save a life in such a profound way for me is wonderful. But I think we have the sort of the fear, I don't know, we risk doing the kind of David Cameron big society thing and making it sound so easy if we were all a bit more Boy Scout and a bit less kind of, you know, individual success focused, the world would be a better place. I think there's something about seeking meaning and finding meaning in life, which is not always the same as kind of, you know, being able to picture yourself doing doing a good deed and telling everybody about it.
So talking about meaning for life, I want to ask you about prayer and the difference, well, the power of prayer and whether it makes a difference if it's communal or individual.
So Judaism pushes the communal prayer initiative. You know, we're instructed to pray with a minyan with at least 10 people, because there's that sense of our focus shifts away from ourselves and into the kind of the utilitarian kind of greatest good for the greatest number kind of outlet. And also, I would say putting one's personal prayer within a collective also does something different. It's a call to action. If the rest of the community understand what it is that you need. I think that the challenge is often our prayer services become very sanitized and very, we're just going through the ropes and trying to find the nugget, the individual within the communal in those moments, really being able to use our own language and really being able to pray sometimes takes quite a lot of discipline because you're sort of doing it personally and internally whilst the more kind of, you know, communal prayer is going on around you. But there's something very, you know, self-soothing, self-calming about prayer and the ability to be able to kind of help you recognize what are my priorities right now? What do I need? What am I articulating in this moment? Where is my head going? Which I think says a lot about us in those moments of what's truly important and what we need. So I think there's, you know, for me, the best, I would say, the top kind of element of prayer is truly personal prayer within a collective setting. It's just not always easy to find the moments and find the spaces where that's possible.
So on to Wellspring. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as being a community way of supporting the individuals?
Absolutely. I think that exactly what Wellspring endeavours to do is to create the communities of people, exactly as Mark was describing, of what does it mean to find your people also who are living through this, who have experienced that, who are kind of in that same place. So what does it mean to give community and to feel heard? So to be able to come to a space that says there will always be someone here who will be there to talk to you, to hear you, and to help you, I think, balance two things. Because I think if we're talking about Wellspring as a place also of kind of recovery, I think there's something about balancing goals and kind of being able to look forward and kindness that others are showing to you and that you're able to show yourself. And that getting that balance right of being able to support people both in their goal setting and feeling that they are being treated with kindness and being able to be kind to themselves is exactly what we're looking to create.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you both of you, and have good weeks and months, everyone.
Thank you.